Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra continues its season tomorrow evening with an all Brahms program featuring two of the composer's most beloved works. Pianist William Wolfram, medalist at the William Capel, Naumburg, and Tchaikovsky piano competitions, will be the soloist for the Piano Concerto No. 1, and the symphony's second work will be the Sunny Symphony No. 2 in D. Stephen Smith, music director of the Richmond Symphony Orchestra, will be the conductor for the evening, and he's our guest today. Smith is in his fourth season at Richmond and previously served as music director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus, where he served 14 seasons. He's also served on the conducting staff at the Cleveland Orchestra and the Oberlin Conservatory. He's also an ASCAP award-winning composer, with commissions from the Cleveland Orchestra, the Grand Rapids Symphony, the Eugene Youth Symphony, among many solo artists as well. He'll be leading the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in the music of Johannes Brahms tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Smith, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and welcome to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
As our orchestra is one that uses guest conductors completely, it's always interesting to know how this invitation comes about, because as you well know, orchestral musicians, while they may be in one city through the year, in the summer they go to music festivals all around the country. So how did the invitation come about in this particular
Well,
case?
You're right. And the music business, we always joke about it, is a very small world. I mean, it's 2 degrees of separation, if that. Everybody knows somebody else. And this invitation, I think, came about through a member of the orchestra who had actually known me a number of years ago when I was in Cleveland and serving as music director of the Cleveland Orchestra, Youth Orchestra, and also assistant conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra. And I think one of those musicians, trombonist, as a matter of fact, had played with me then and apparently recently had seen my name somewhere or thought about me and so wrote and asked if I'd be interested in coming. I said, sure, I'd love to come. So eventually, here we are.
Now, this particular program is somewhat unusual because it's very unusual to have one program where it's one composer. And in this case, it's just two big works by Johannes Brahms.
Yeah. In my opinion, anyway, I think there are very few composers that can sustain an entire concert of their own music. We tend to do it a fair amount with Beethoven, and that's, I think, quite logical and very, very powerful. But one of the other few is Brahms. And while this concert looks like it could be a lot of the same thing on the surface, it really isn't. Because
in fact, it's two works in the key of D.
But fortunately, minor and major.
Yes.
And the way Brahms departs from his keys, you know, you'll get them all in the course of the evening, pretty much. So they're two very, very different pieces. They're both war horses of their own right. And they're both incredibly strong, very emotionally powerful compositions. But they're of very, very different worlds. The Piano Concerto is a very early piece. I mean, he's barely in his 20s at that point. It's very turbulent. It's at the same time, it's very introspective. It's very dance-like in some ways as we get into the last movement. But then the symphony, of course, Brahms, very, very well known how Brahms delayed writing any symphonies at all. In fact, this Piano Concerto set out to be a symphony in its one of its early incarnations. And by the time he was writing his second symphony, now he was well into his 40s. And it's in many ways Brahms' sunniest piece. It's incredibly friendly and generous. And it just is one of the most boisterous and fun pieces to play. It's got the best ending of almost any piece I know in the repertoire in the final movement. So on the surface, it looks like a very similar kind of program between the concerto and the symphony. But in fact, they're worlds apart.
And it's really interesting. The Piano Concerto was written young, the symphony in his middle years. But if you actually looked at it at the surface, just a quick listen, you might think that was reversed because the symphony is... It has this youthful vigor, although when you actually delve into it, it's crafted much, much, in many ways, better. But it has this sort of sunny disposition of youth, and yet the Piano Concerto, when he's young, it reminds us that Brahms must have been a real brooding youth.
I think you're right. If you think about that idea of, you know, a traditional sort of span of life where one is young and exuberant and gradually takes on greater seriousness with age, it is a little bit backwards in that way. I think that Brahms was deeply affected at a very young age by his connection to Robert and Clara Schumann. Robert Schumann's branding of Brahms as, you know, the next great composer composer after Beethoven. When he first met the kid, he was 20 at this point, to suddenly have that label put on you. And I'm sure that this had a huge effect on Brahms as a young man, to suddenly have this shadow of this enormous figure ahead of time, and to be essentially given, I mean, Schumann was an incredibly influential person through his journal, and to suddenly have this imprimatur put on you that you're going to be the next great composer. I mean, how do you deal with that when you're 20
years old? How do you even
write? Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, he threw out a lot of music. We know that for a fact. There was a number of early pieces that he discarded later on. And so he was his own worst critic in many ways. And so I think that he did have a kind of tortured youth in a certain way, trying to find his way in the world. And that, of course, is one reason he did delay actually writing a symphony, because he did not want to be compared too closely with the model, particularly Beethoven's Ninth, which hung over everybody, still does, for that matter, to this day. But the concerto, though, when you hear it right from the very first measures, it's incredibly exciting. It just launches you immediately into this world. There's a story, Joachim, the great violinist and friend of Brahms, later said that he had understood that the opening of this piano concerto was actually had a direct connection to Robert Schumann's suicide attempt when he threw himself into the Rhine. And you actually hear that at the beginning of this piece, that kind of turmoil that could be both Schumann's inner turmoil, but it could also be Brahms' inner turmoil at his place in the world and trying to figure out where he was going to go as a composer. He was, of course, a pianist, so this was his vehicle. And the worlds apart of this opening theme of this symphony and the great second theme that the piano brings in its solo capacity, I mean, they're a fusing of these two very, very different kinds of worlds. And I think from an emotional standpoint, this is what Brahms was dealing with. Now, we got to be careful not to go too far down the psychological path, I think, of trying to delve into composers' most inner workings. But I think you can see that very clearly here, and I think that it does show itself in Brahms' work.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that opening music from the Piano Concerto No. 1. My guest today is Stephen Smith, music director of the Richmond Symphony Orchestra and guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony this Saturday night at 7:30 in an all-Brahms concert, which will feature William Wolfram on this Piano Concerto No. 1. Here's a recording of the opening, that opening theme we're talking about here on Studio Tulsa. That's music from the Brahms Piano Concerto No. 1, one of two works to be performed by Brahms on the next Tulsa Symphony Orchestra concert tomorrow evening at 7:30. My guest today is Stephen Smith, the music director of the Richmond Symphony and guest conductor for the orchestra. And both of these works are usually concert concluders.
That's true. Yeah. This is one of those concertos that is a second half piece, very definitely.
Right. And so is the symphony.
Yeah.
Do you flip a coin or what?
I guess in this case, I mean, this wasn't actually my decision in this particular case, but I mean, you honestly could, although frankly, I can't imagine doing the symphony and ending that before intermission and coming back for the concerto, but you could. I mean, they're both strong, strong pieces. So in this performance, we're going back to the old model of concerto before intermission and symphony after. So.
Yeah. Is that unusual to do just two works like that for you as a conductor?
It is. I usually like to start with something.
Warm up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just for a variety of reasons, particularly if it's not a program that is involving a single composer. It's nice to have an opening piece that somehow informs the rest of the concert, is connected in some way or another. There's also a very practical aspect of allowing latecomers a chance to sit down after a 10-minute overture or whatever, although I appreciate it if people come on time, obviously, but things can happen. And there's also just sort of the idea, especially I think when we consider how concerts are part of our world today, it's a different kind of thing than during Brahms' time, for example. You know, we have to make an effort to go to a concert, and it's something that is so crucial about the concert experience, is making that effort to share the experience with other people, this live performance that will never be this way again. And to connect on a purely emotional and personal level with the musicians and the composer, you can't do that with the finest stereo system, with the greatest HD broadcast. You're still not in the room feeling that energy. That's why live performances continue to be so important. So to allow for sort of getting into that experience, I think having an opening piece allows for an audience to feel their way in there, and for the orchestra too, for that matter, to just sort of put ourselves in this wonderful space that we're going to share for a couple of hours. So we don't have that in this case, but on the other hand, what we do have is this incredibly powerful opening we just heard that, you know, in a way is like a quick jump in the pool or the Rhine, as the case may be, as opposed to dipping your toe and finding your way in gradually. It's just a different way to get into the concert experience.
And in this case, you have, again, a big piece like this that you're doing a show about one composer. I know you're very big in education. This is a big part of your background. Mm-hmm. Is there any sense in a concert like this, since you're doing one composer, to share something about this? Or does this music speak for itself?
I mean, you can go down a couple paths here. I think this music does speak for itself. I mean, that the continuing popularity of Brahms as one of audience favorites forever points to that. But it does, I think, present an opportunity to reflect a little bit, not during the concert probably, but certainly during the pre-concert interview or through opportunities like this, to talk a little bit about Brahms' influence as a composer, the mantle that he did inherit from Beethoven. We can look back historically, it's very, very clear. And what Brahms did to move from what Beethoven revolutionized about orchestral music in particular, the use of very clear and distinct and often very simple motifs, and using them to build incredible structures through repetition and development, Brahms picked up on that, absolutely. And for instance, this Second Symphony starts with the simplest of materials, a half step, da, 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 and this gorgeous horn melody, which is nothing more than the notes of a D major chord. Da, 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 dee, da, da, da. And so, and then what Brahms is able to build out of that, what he built on from Beethoven, was a greater degree of rhythmic sophistication, of rhythmic flexibility. Beethoven loved to play around with the beats. So does Brahms. In fact, Brahms mixes them up even more. And the other thing that Brahms was so wonderful at was his harmonic delvings. He'll find his way so far away from the main key of a piece, and yet it's so smooth that you don't even realize how far away you've gotten until you're making the journey back. And he does that as smoothly. That's not necessarily the kind of thing that an audience might or might pick up on. It depends on their level of musical knowledge and experience. You don't have to appreciate the journey that Brahms takes us on. It's such a clear path that he gives us. He'll take us so far away from our opening music or the climactic music, and the way he builds into it. I'm thinking particularly of the fourth movement of the symphony, which finds its way into this incredibly... The music literally comes to a halt, and yet there we are. And suddenly we're back in the moment, and then he builds to this extraordinary climax at the end. I mean, one other small thing about Brahms that I've always loved and admired, and something that I feel like I learned a great deal from him as a composer myself, are his uncanny sense for transitions and for finding a way into a new section without even realizing you're there. It's amazing how he does it. Sometimes it's a single note.
And I was thinking about, you were talking about going far afield and all of a sudden bringing it back. The way he brings it back a lot of times is you sort of meander off the trail, and then all of a sudden you jump back on the trail.
Yeah.
But the jump is entirely natural, and it has this way of oh, wow, here we are. You know, it's a revelation.
Yeah.
Really.
I think there's very much, I mean, we're talking about paths and all of that. And Brahms was a nature lover. I mean, he loved walks in the woods. He loved his time outdoors. And this symphony is in many ways all about nature. It's about taking a walk in the countryside. The way it unfolds at the very beginning is like suddenly is opening your door in a cabin somewhere and just beginning to enjoy the day gradually unfolding. And then you experience everything in the course of your walk. And it's very much, I think, a piece absolutely rooted in the natural world. And that's something else, like the concert experience, that binds us together is our sharing of our environment.
That idea of the nature walk, is there a moment in the symphony that you can think of that sort of depicts that?
I think the whole thing is a nature walk, to be honest. I mean, that opening, as I talked about, I think I could pick any number of examples, but the opening of the last movement, which is a fast movement, and yet it opens so quietly, but yet with a lot of activity. So it's almost like that moment when... I don't know, you could equate it to the moment of climbing up a ridge, and it's very, very quiet. You're working hard because you're going, your heart's beating, so you feel that inner energy, but you don't get the view yet. And suddenly you reach the top of the view, and there's boom. This sudden forte, and there it is. We're at the top of the mountain.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the opening of the fourth movement of Brahms, Johannes Brahms Symphony No. 2, one of two works to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night. Music of Brahms. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra will be presenting an all Brahms concert with my guest today, Stephen Smith, a guest conductor, music director of the Richmond Symphony. Earlier, you alluded to the fact that you were also a composer. Were you a composer first, conductor second, or conductor first, composer second?
Well, actually, I was a violinist first.
I was interested in how somebody goes to the podium. Yeah. Was it a matter of you played in the orchestra and said, I want to do this?
If you really wanted to distill it into a sentence, like that. It's a little longer story. It's funny how many different paths there are. But I started playing the violin when I was a kid. I became interested in conducting and composition when I was in high school. I just started composing. One day I realized I heard music in my head that I didn't recognize, and so I tried to write it down. So in a way, that came first, and I became interested in conducting, but it's sort of sat on a back burner for many, many years. And I played professionally as a violinist for a while. And yeah, I played in a lot of orchestras. It's concertmaster of the Grand Rapids Symphony out of school. And I realized at a certain point that I was still interested in the bigger picture. I was interested in the full score. I was interested in trying to bring composers' music to life. And that was obviously directly related to my own life as a composer. And so I made the switch at a certain point. And I realized that all three parts of my life have influenced another. I wouldn't give up any of them for anything. What I learn as a composer helps me as a conductor, and what I learn as a conductor helps me as a composer.
And being the player, too, within the orchestra setting, has got to know what's actually doable when you're writing or being a part of that ensemble.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things I love most about the work that I do now is that it's a lifelong, here we are talking about journeys again, it's a lifelong journey. There's something new to be learned every single day, every time I come back to two pieces like this, these great, great war horses, we forget some. We sometimes lament, oh, we're just playing the war horses again. But they're war horses for a reason. They've stood the test of time, and we respect them and learn something new from them every single time. I open the score to Brahms second every time I do it and find something entirely new and different, or a different answer to a question that I had the previous time. So it never ends. And that's, I can't imagine a more wonderful way to spend one's life is this, in the company of geniuses like this and sharing and learning about their music.
How do you balance composition with conducting? Because, you know, there are, you know, you look at some of our finest music in the repertoire, you know, whether it's Mahler or Bernstein or... Yeah. You know, a lot of these guys did both equally well. I think it's really tough. And there's,
I agree, it is tough. And
some
and,
were composers first, and not so great conductors either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there've been
both ways.
Exactly. I think it really depends for a lot of the people you cite and people who've lived that kind of life and continue to. It depends on their working method. My working method as a composer, it doesn't unfortunately lend itself to being able to sit down and write for a couple of hours and then get up and go to rehearsal. I have too much other music going in my head when I'm actively performing.
I would think just the act of being a conductor, you're thinking about other people's music, not your own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All the time. And so for me, if I know I've got either, if I have a piece I know I have to write or want to write, I need 2 or 3 weeks to just get out of anywhere and go out somewhere in the middle of nowhere, try to forget all of the music that I've been involved with and find my way into that world. And I kind of have to stay there. I mean, at a certain point, you know, when the piece has begun to really take shape and you get into a lot of the detail work, then it's possible for me to go back and find time in between. It is hard for me to find time to compose. And I actually haven't written much of anything in the last several years since I've started in Richmond. It's been a lot of duties, and I was finishing up another position in Santa Fe. And so it's been very, very difficult to find any time at all. And I do miss it. But on the other hand, I love being on stage and sharing this music with musicians and audiences. So, you know, I'll find time for it.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Richmond Symphony. What's special about it?
I think one thing that's incredibly special about it is their willingness to work incredibly hard. And there's, you know, for better or worse, there's sort of an old saw in the orchestra business that orchestras get to a point where they just sort of get jaded and they just they complain about playing the Tchaikovsky Fifth every other year, but then they don't necessarily want to play anything else either. It's unfortunate. I've experienced from time to time orchestras like that. Not too many, fortunately.
I think given the financial futures of orchestras, when you just look around the country, that attitude is sort of disappearing.
Well, it is, and it has to. I mean, there's no place for it. I mean, why do we do what we do if we don't love what we do? I mean, I think the rebirth of the Tulsa Symphony is a great example. There's some very, very difficult history here, without question, and some tough times. But now, you know, there's this nucleus of players who've basically stood up for the music and stood up for the organization.
Put it on their own shoulders, too.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. They've taken that responsibility, and I commend them highly, highly for that. We don't have that situation in Richmond. We have a more traditional kind of structure, but we do have an orchestra that's very committed to a wide range of activities, that is committed to giving the best performances possible on whatever stage they happen to be on. There's just a wonderful youthful energy about the orchestra that there have been a number of younger players joining the orchestra in recent years. So I've come into it at a wonderful time, and they just share this kind of passion for music and share a passion for bringing this music to audiences. It's been a wonderful start of a journey for me.
That's interesting. You're a soloist for the evening, William Wolfram, who's a highly decorated pianist and numerous recordings, a great musician, will be the soloist in the piano concerto. You never worked with him until, what, 3 weeks ago for the opening of your season?
As we were just chatting, yeah. I've known about Bill for years, and you know, I've heard him, and he's, as you say, quite highly acclaimed, and we have mutual friends, of course, here in the business. But I'd never had a chance to work with him, so we had arranged to bring him to Richmond to open this season, and then lo and behold, he was the soloist for this concert to come a couple of weeks later. So, and we had a wonderful time in Richmond, so we're definitely looking forward to having a wonderful time here.
What do you like most about his play?
I loved the fact we did the Beethoven Fourth Concerto together. And, you know, that's, again, meat and potatoes repertoire.
Yes, it is.
Which Bill is kind of known for as well. What I loved about his approach in the Beethoven was a respect for Beethoven, a respect for the score, and a respect for tradition, and yet at the same time finding his own personality, for letting it ebb and flow in a personal way. And it was interesting when we sat down to have our usual pre-rehearsal chat. Every soloist approaches that differently. Every conductor approaches it differently. Some soloists are very, very clear about what they want here and there. And Bill was very much not like that. We talked about a few little things, and then we sort of both agreed to just kind of let it be a little more organic and see. And so he's the kind of soloist that is very responsive to a situation. He's not locked into, this is the way I play it. He's very much in the moment and allows for, and even between performances, allows for a little bit of flexibility. He'll pick up some things from me. I'll pick up some things from him. He'll pick up some things from the orchestra. It's really, it was a wonderful experience. And so I'm sure that it's going to be as much the same, and maybe even expanded on this expansive piece.
I would think it's almost like, okay, now we have this rapport that we created 3 weeks ago. Now let's really do it.
That's exactly right. Yeah, to have that chance. It doesn't happen all that often to pick up again with that same relationship. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, we're excited about the program. An all Brahms program from the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center with my guest today, Stephen Smith, the music director of the Richmond Symphony Orchestra. Now, it's tough balancing guest conducting with being a music director. Is that something you do a lot of, or just a few dates a year?
It really is just a few. And in the last couple of years, as I was sort of balancing these two positions in this transition time in my life between Santa Fe and Richmond, it was very difficult to find time to do that. Some conductors seem to find a way to do this. They're on planes constantly.
Yeah, they thrive on seeing new orchestras and going everywhere.
Yeah.
Are you a person that likes to stay in one place and work with your own orchestra?
Well, I'm kind of in the middle somewhere. I do like that. I like very much having that day-to-day relationship with the orchestra and the community, which is a very important part of being a music director today, is having a connection to the community and building other relationships. And I've really enjoyed doing that in Richmond. But at the same time, it is fun to go and experience other orchestras and other situations. You know, I find I always learn something in a different situation. I try to work with young people when I can. I periodically will go to universities and work with orchestras. I enjoy that very much, or summer festivals. So it's just a constant kind of balancing act and seeing when the dates mesh in the right way. I like a blend of both, really. It's, I think, healthy for any orchestra not to see the same person all the time. So we do have guests in Richmond periodically, and I think that's important. I think we all learn from new experiences, so being able to have that little bit of back and forth is really helpful.
Well, we look forward to a great concert. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Smith is the music director of the Richmond Symphony Orchestra and guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra as they perform an all Johannes Brahms concert tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Pianist William Wolfram will be featured on the Piano Concerto No. 1, and the Symphony No. 2 rounds out the program. For information, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.